Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the Two Guys Talking Podcast Network. Thank you.
Welcome to the Pediatric Sports Medicine Podcast, hosted by me, Dr. Mark Halstead. I cover current hot topics and recent research in the world of the young athlete relevant to healthcare professionals. This is the Pediatric Sports Medicine Podcast.
We are back to finish out Brain Injury Awareness Month, looking at another component of the SCAT 6. Today we're going to tackle what I consider to be the OG version of the SCAT, otherwise known as the SAC, or the Standardized Assessment of Concussion. We certainly love acronyms in sports medicine, don't we? Let's take the deep dive. I'm Dr. Mark Halstead, your host, and this is the Pediatric Sports Medicine Podcast. Last time we tackled the Maddox questions. Now it's time to discuss the Standardized Assessment of Concussion, or the SAC. What are the origins of it, and what has the research demonstrated over the years? Shortly after the Maddox questions were published, the American Academy of Neurology adopted a practice parameter for management of concussion. They made a call for the development of a standardized systematic evaluation for sideline assessment of concussion for athletic trainers and others. This was preceded by the Colorado Medical Society publishing their guidelines 4 years prior in 1991. The specific features were actually meant to develop something that tested orientation, in addition to evaluating for problems with attention, concentration, and memory. If you are old enough, you remember all the three different kind of guidelines there, the American Academy of Neurology's guidelines, the Colorado Medical Society's guidelines, and then the CANTU guidelines that were kind of the three top ways of assessing for concussion. They also had their individual grading scales. This led to Dr. Mike McCrae, a neuropsychologist, Dr. James Kelly, and some others to evaluate the utility of a tool. And this was done in 1995 on high school varsity football players in Iowa. They had 141 non-concussed football players from three different schools in Iowa. They tested 76 as control during games and then 65 during practice. The athletic trainers involved also were to test anyone suspected of having a concussion during the season. They actually found that there were six players who had suspected concussion in games during the season. I always chuck a little bit at these pre-2000 concussion studies is that they defined them all as grade one concussions, which meant brief confusion but no loss of consciousness. And all six of those players did actually have a baseline test to compare. So what's involved with the SAC? And I'm going to go again with the OG SAC here, the one that was originally designed here. There were four components. The first was orientation. This included remembering the month, the date, the day of the week, the year, and the time within an hour. And you can get a 5-point total score there. I don't know if any of you are those that do sideline assessments. I always struggle with this one personally myself, especially for the date to the day of the week and the month and year and time within an hour. I can probably get pretty good. But that date itself, unless I've actually recently been in clinic, that one I usually have to look down myself to make sure that the athlete is answering it correctly. The second component is immediate memory, which involved repeating 5 words over 3 separate trials. And that also could amount to a total of 15 points. And then concentration was next, which included initially reciting digits in reverse, going from strings of 3 numbers up to 6 numbers. And so as an example, if they gave you a string of 1, 2, 3, then the athlete would give you 3, 2, 1 in reverse. And then they also had the months of the year in reverse. And you can get up to 4 points for reverse digits and then 1 point for the months of the year in reverse. And then finally, it ended with delayed recall of the previous 5-word set for another possible 5 points. And that delayed recall was done 5 minutes after you did the initial immediate memory assessment. So if you did everything correctly, if you could have a maximum score of 30 on this particular assessment. Interestingly, going back to the original description there, to allow for that 5 minutes of time to be allotted between the immediate and delayed recall test, it was suggested to do neurologic screening, including the athlete's recollection of the injury, their strength, sensation, and coordination. And interestingly, I actually forgot this was part of it. There was a group of exertional maneuvers that were suggested as well, including a 40-yard sprint, doing 5 sit-ups, 5 push-ups, and 5 knee bends. I would actually love to see that done on the sidelines these days and see what people thought of athletes going through this routine on the sidelines. What did they find? Well, if you looked at the controls compared to the concussed athletes, orientation really didn't help. So that was those 5 questions asking about date, day of the week, time, things like that. In fact, actually, the concussed athletes did slightly better on this, but not statistically significant. When you got to the immediate memory, this is the one that seemed to be the biggest struggle for the concussed athletes in this study. So on immediate memory, the average there was 14.5 for a score, for the 141 controls. On the concussed athletes, they got an average of 12 out of a possible 15. When we got to the concentration question, so this was actually getting through the digits in reverse as well as the months of the year in reverse, which again was a maximum of 5 points for this. They actually, it was only 2.19 as the mean for the controls, with 1.5 for the concussed athletes. That was not also, again, found to be statistically significant. And then they also struggled with delayed recall. So this, again, is a maximum of 5 of recalling those initial 5 word strings. So the controls got an average of 4.12, and the concussed athletes got 3.2, and that was found to be statistically significant. And then if you actually took the controls, then their average total score was 25.6. The concussed athletes was 21.5. So there was a decrease there of almost, well, actually a little over 4 points from the initial assessment in this small study of concussed athletes. There was only, again, 6 in this study compared to the 141 controls. So what it was found is that the orientation questions were not as found to be as useful as what it seemed like the Maddox questions, if you go back to the previous episode where we took the deep dive into the Maddox questions. So then a follow-up study by McCray and others was published in 1998, so a few years after this, where baseline assessments were conducted on 353 high school athletes and then 215 college male football players through the 1995 and 1996 season. 33 players in this cohort were identified as having a concussion, once again using the grade 1 concussion classification. A follow-up evaluation was done on 28 of the 33 athletes that had concussions, with an assessment done 48 hours after the initial assessment. And then the 5 who were not actually included out of that 33, they were actually in an earlier phase of the study before they did actually looking at this 48-hour follow-up test. So what was found here? So a little bit different on this particular assessment. So with orientation, again, the mean was 4.82 for those that were in the normal controls. The concussed athletes actually were at 4.30 for their mean score. So that was actually found to be statistically significant in this group with a larger number of concussed athletes and a larger, much, much, much larger number of controls with 568 controls. Memory was also found to be statistically significant for the immediate memory. So it was 14.51. was the mean for the normal controls, 13.03. Again, this is out of a total of 15 for the concussed athletes. Concentration was also found to be statistically significantly different between the concussed and the controlled athletes. So the mean was 3.40 for the controls, 2.64 for the concussed athletes. And then delayed recall also was found to be statistically significant. So it was an average of 3.84, again, out of 5. For those that were the normal controls, and then 2.91 for the concussed athletes. And if you looked at the total score here again, and remember, it's a total of 30, it was 26.58 for the normal controls and then 22.88 for the concussed athletes. So it was found to be statistically significant in this particular study between all of these athletes. So then I mentioned that they did this 48-hour after the concussion assessment. And this is the interesting part. And this is where really when we talk about conclusions later, will be kind of still the highlight because this has been found consistent to be the case with multiple studies. So at 48 hours after the concussion, athletes actually performed at a level slightly better than their baseline. So if we looked at the average in the concussed players at baseline, they were at 26.3 for their total score on the SAC. They moved down to 22.8 for the time of the concussion assessment. And then they 48 hours later were back up to 27.4. So actually, again, exceeding there, but it was not found to be statistically significant there from the baseline. So there is not a very long period of time where the SAC appears to be useful, at least from this particular study. So if we move on again, McCray did a lot of research on the SAC as one of the main people who developed this. And there was another study published in the Journal of Athletic Training in 2001. And what this did, it actually looked at characteristics of the scores for injured and control subjects again. So they had a group of uninjured controls as well as concussed athletes. And what they looked at here is, again, when looking at the SAC scores on the concussed athletes compared to those that were at baseline, they did not find any difference for those that were the controls versus the injured subjects for their baseline SAC scores. Those were found to be the same. But when they were concussed, that was found to be statistically significantly different for all the orientations. So total score went from 26.87 to 22.46 from going from the normal controls mean to the concussed. The orientation, again, was significant with 4.78 for the non-injured controls, and then the injured subjects were 4.17. Immediate memory was 14.29 for the controls, and then 12.92 for the injured athletes here, and then 3.67 for the concentration. So again, that's the digits in reverse and months of the year backwards, compared to 2.6 for those that were concussed. And then the delayed recall was 4.13 for the uninjured controls and 2.76 for the injured subjects. And once again, they did this assessment 48 hours afterwards, and they did demonstrate that those that were concussed, they went back to their normal level within 48 hours after their concussion on the performance on the SAC. So they actually tried to use this study to determine the sensitivity and specificity. So they found if there was a decrease from the baseline scores, your concussion diagnosis using the SAC was 95% sensitive and 76% specific. When we move on to a different study that actually looked at U.S. Naval Academy football players, it was a study by Daniel published in Military Medicine in October of 2002. What they found here is initially the baseline versus concussed. So again, the baseline athletes, there was 21 that they had in this group, so much smaller study. They had a mean of 27.8 for their baseline assessment when they were concussed. They were found to be at 24.5. So there was a statistically significant difference there between the two groups. And then when you looked at the positions, there was a difference number-wise, but it wasn't found to be statistically significant. So offensive players had a mean score of 28.2 out of 30, defensive players had 28 out of 30, and then the special teams athletes had 27.5 for their mean out of 30. And then if we looked again at another article by McCray and others, it looked at recovery time in NCAA collegiate football players. I remember this study very, very well. And as soon as I went through it, I remember the graphs, and I use these in so many of my PowerPoint presentations early on, giving presentations about concussions and athletes. So this brought back some fond memories when I saw these charts. I'm like, I remember those things that I use all the time. So what was looked at here? This is actually, again, looking at collegiate football players. There were 1,631 in this prospective cohort study. They did baseline testing on the 1999, 2000, and 2001 seasons. They had 94 players who identified having a concussion by the AANS criteria. And then they compared those concussed athletes to 56 non-injured controls. And what they did is they looked at their symptoms, their cognitive function, and their postural stability. And they looked at them immediately after the concussion, 3 hours later, and then at 1, 2, 3, 5, and 7 days, as well as 90 days after the injury. So no player got excluded out of this. And so what did we find? So symptom recovery, this is where we saw a lot of the initial studies talking about the 7-day recovery period, because there's, again, this very characteristic graph there of the baseline of their symptom scores, and then at the concussion point, and then post-game, and then from days 1 through 7, and showing that the symptoms recovered by day 7 in this particular cohort. So this is why you hear a lot, or you heard a lot for a long time, about the 7-day recovery period. When you looked at cognitive recovery, so again, this was looking at the SAC. So what they saw is there was a statistically significant decline at the time of the concussion assessment, post-game at day 1, and then by day 2, again, that 48 hours afterwards, there was no statistically significant difference in the assessment of the SAC. So we keep seeing consistently now here that 48 hours seems to be the utility for doing the SAC on somebody. And then when we start looking at postural stability, this was looking at the BESS here back in this particular study. They showed that the BESS scores seem to also be statistically significantly different between the athletes only for the first, looks like probably by the study, if I remember correctly, for the first couple of days at the most. But really, the balance differences in the concussed athletes improved pretty quickly. It was actually found to be helpful right at the time of the injury, post-game. But then once you got into day 1 and day 2 afterwards, there really was not much difference between the two. So moving on to another study, the first study I can find that actually included females looking at the SAC, looked at grade school age group also, which was interesting because this was a younger group that we talk about not having enough research. And this was actually done by a good friend and a past podcast guest, Dr. Tamara McLeod. This was published in the Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine in 2004. And this was a cohort looking at athletes between the ages of 9 and 14. So it was looking at 50 healthy young athletes. And they were assigned to either a control or a practice group. And what they were trying to do is see if there was a practice effect of doing these particular assessments. So they looked at them on 2 different occasions, 60 days apart. And so what they found here is when we did the BESS, or when they did the BESS on somebody, there was actually a learning effect on serial BESS testing in the practice group. So that was interesting. So the scores got lower. And so that would imply that they are getting better at it. So if you know that and familiar with the best, a higher score means that you have more errors, which also means that you're struggling more. So there was a learning effect that was there that was found to be significant across all subjects. There was not found to be a practice or learning effect with serial SAC test administration. So that was the interesting part here. So it looks like there is some stability of using the SAC. And again, this is even including in a group ages 9 to 14. There was another study that, again, I also remember using this particular study as well, and it was published by Grubenhoff in Pediatrics in October of 2010. So now a little bit more of a delay, or a little bit more years, 6 years after the last study that I'm quoting. It looked at the utility of the sac in a pediatric ER setting. So they actually looked at it according to groups of ages. And so they had a 6 to 8 year old group, a 9 to 11 year old age group, 12 to 14 and 15 to 18. So they had those that were controls and then also those that were injured. Interestingly, the scores improve as you would kind of expect in using this test as the kids got older. So in those that were concussed, they actually performed better on average in the 6 to 8 year old age group than the base or the ones that were controls. So the ones that were concussed scored 18.4 again out of 30 compared to 17.7 in those that were the controls. Once we hit the 9 to 11 year old age group, then we started to see a little bit of a difference here. So the average scores, the mean went up to 22.1. for those that were concussed, 22.7 for those that were the normal controls. When you got to the 12 to 14 year old age group, this is where we started to see some significance. And it was the only age group that actually had significance for the sac for those that were injured compared to the controls. So the injured group was 22.5 out of 30. The controls were 25. And then once we got to the 15 to 18 year old age group, it was not found to be statistically significantly different, but the case controls were lower at 24.9 out of 30, as opposed to the controls at 26. They also looked at the graded symptom checklist, and this is where we see a lot of studies that talk about how the most sensitive test and the best test to still use are the symptom checklists. So that was actually found in all age groups to be statistically significantly different and more predictive of a concussion than the sac was in this particular group. So it wasn't found to have any statistical significance between the controls and concussion patients, but the symptom checklist did. Just talking about a couple other studies briefly, there was a study by Zimmer published in 2013 in the Journal of Athletic Training. This evaluated for differences in performance by collegiate team, sex, or sport, and there was not found to be any difference for the sac performance in any of those groups, so team, sex, or sport. In 2016, there was a study by Chin published in American Journal of Sports Medicine that looked at the reliability and validity of the SCAT3 components in high school and collegiate athletes. What they found here is that male athletes and those who had ADHD or learning disabilities had lower SAC baseline scores in this particular group when they kind of teased out different groups here. A study by a colleague, Tracy Sneddon, was published in the Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine in September 2017 that showed that females performed slightly better than males at baseline with the SAC at 26.4 versus 26.1. And most studies that actually have female athletes in them generally show that they do tend to perform better than males, which is what we see almost all the time with these particular assessments. Concussion history in those ages of 13 to 15 and 16 to 18 did not really show any differences between the groups. And then athletes with learning disabilities or ADHD and those with headache or migraine history also did worse on their baseline assessments on the SAC compared to those that did not have that history or those issues, the learning disabilities or ADHD. There's been other recent studies to suggest that actually the native language may affect performance. So comparing English to Spanish speakers, there was a difference there where the Spanish speakers performed worse. And then also the child SAC was not able to be effectively determine concussed or non-concussed athletes. So lots of studies that are out there, and this is just a smattering of them. Most of the other studies that I didn't quote specifically have pretty much the same conclusions as the ones that I outlined here. I will make sure to have those particular studies I talked about and specifically reviewed for this particular episode in our show notes, so you can certainly check those out and go and look at those actual studies themselves. And we'll be right back after a quick break.
Thought about a career in voiceover? Need a great, cost-effective on-hold message for your organization or business? Don't know where to start? Check out The Voice Farm, your one-stop shop for voiceover needs. Check it out now by accessing The Voice Farm at voicefarmers.com and see what difference can be made with a company that is truly outside the box. From The Voice Box, voicefarmers.com. That's voicefarmers.com.
Dr. Mark Halstead here. Do you like what you're hearing on the Pediatric Sports Medicine Podcast? If you want to learn how your business, organization, or effort can benefit from my focused audience of professionals interested in pediatric sports medicine, connect with us and let's have a conversation. You can reach out to us at pediatricsportsmedicinepodcast.com.
In today's world, time is everything. When editing podcasts, you know as well as I do, time flies. But it's not the good kind of time flying. It's the kind of time that eats a hole in your pocket. Reclaim the time you lose when you edit your podcast. Connect with The Editor Corps. The Editor Corps is a group of seasoned, experienced podcast editors that'll get your editing done and out the door. Use your reclaimed time to make more content. Make your podcast soar with The Editor Corps. EditorCorps.com. That's EditorCorps.com.
And now back to the podcast. So why months of the year in reverse as an assessment? This is also another study that I actually quoted almost all the time when I did my early concussion talks. I don't really use it anymore, but I'll still come back to it on occasion when I talk to people about the particular with months of the year in reverse. And this was a study that was done in the Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine, or it was published in the Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine in 1997. This was actually a study by Craig Young, who's up in Milwaukee. He looked at high school athletes in grades 9 through 12 at their PPEs, and this was 522 consecutive athletes that were done here. And so what they did here is they asked them to perform several different things. They wanted to do serial sevens, serial threes, and then finally reciting the months of the year backwards. The second group, they had two groups here, was asked to perform the same test in a random order. So interestingly here, if you don't know what serial sevens are, the way that that works, or serial threes, is you start at 100, and for serial sevens, you count backwards and give the numbers. So if you're going to do serial sevens, you'd say 100, 93, 86, and et cetera, et cetera. And you'd go through as many as you could. And then serial threes would be, again, 100, 97, 94, 91. And again, continue to follow that pattern back down. So they got a 1 minute time limit for each test, and the passing score was either 7 consecutive correct or 11 correct with one mistake. So what do we find here in these high school athletes at a baseline, non-concussed athletes? Only 51% could perform serial sevens correctly, but based on these parameters here. 79% could do serial threes, and then 90% was able to do the months of the year in reverse. When they did this in a random order, it was slightly better for the serial sevens, up to 53% from 51%. Pretty much the same at 78% for the serial threes, and again, 89% for the months of the year in reverse. So there really wasn't much different in this particular one. They were similar for pass rates for the sexes, the grade levels, and all sports in both test groups. So this is where we saw that serial sevens and serial threes, which were a common assessment that is used in neurology, is probably not as good of assessment as doing months of the year in reverse, which is in part why months of the year in reverse showed up on this particular one. And again, I used to quote that study all the time. So Craig Young got lots and lots of credit on my talks, and a shout out to that particular article. But I think it's important to finish up here just talking about the SAC itself. So we've talked about these studies in terms of just teasing out the components of the SAC. Most of the studies done these days are looking at the SCAT as a whole, and just the SAC being part of that. And we have to remember that currently the SAC is incorporated into the various iterations of the SCAT, which is the Sport Concussion Assessment Tool. So the original SCAT came out in 2005. It had the Maddox questions, but not, interestingly, the SAC orientation questions. So that, again, that was the date, the month, year, where are we, time within an hour. So the original five questions that were on there from the SAC orientation, it didn't include those. And I don't know if that was chosen, because I don't have anything that I can go back to reference to say why specifically those orientation questions, unless it was because they felt the Maddox trumped those. So it did include the word recall, both immediate and delayed, as well as the digits in reverse and months of the year in reverse. So then a few years later, when we had the next iteration of the SCAT, the SCAT 2, it was modified to make it more of something that could be scored. And this was really the only year that there was actually like a true total score for the SCAT 2. If you go back that far, which I believe was 2009 for this, the test was actually designed so you can have a total score of 100. And then you can use that to kind of assess from there what you got out of 100, which seems like it is good. You know, again, I think the problem with a lot of these studies, and my problem still with the SCAT is, all right, we have this information, but, you know, if we don't have a baseline, what does it mean? We can certainly use normal controls, but I don't know how we can make a definitive thing outside of just going through the routine of going through the SCAT when there's not truly like an actual score that's involved. Like, what does it mean? Like, does 2 points mean a difference? But again, if we don't have a baseline, well, what do all those individual numbers mean? And if we want to compare it to the norms, that may be okay, but it may not be okay. And we know that with neurocognitive testing in general, is we can use norms. However, I've had many of examples over the years that if you use a norm, you may actually have a student who actually doesn't fit into those norms. And then you're making a false assumption as far as whether they're recovered from a concussion or they're not performing well on their test. And it could just be how that person is doing. So that's where we did get the orientation questions back into the assessment for the SCAT too. So they did have the Maddox questions and the orientation questions, but that was the only time that we had this total score of 100 for the full SCAT too. And there's some really nice studies out there that show these nice bell-shaped curves as far as how people do in performance on the baselines for these. When we got to the SCAT 3, it did away with the total score, and it didn't really alter anything with the individual tests of the SAC. As you may know, there was no SCAT 4, so when we moved on to the concussion assessments for the fifth meeting, they wanted to make the meetings and the number for the SCAT or the child SCAT or the concussion recognition tools all be similar with what the actual syncing up of the fifth consensus meeting or the sixth consensus meeting as was recently happened. So that's why they just did away with the SCAT 4, because with the original consensus meeting back in 2001 in Vienna, they did not actually develop the SCAT at that point. So they were off by a year. So what did we see in the SCAT 5 now? This was the first one to truly alter the original SAC by adding the alternate 10-word list. And this was trying to deal with a possible ceiling effect for some players. When you got to the 5 words, that just wasn't enough for some. And it was harder to tease those out when that seemed to be the most sensitive test. So they added also some additional number sequences for the digits in reverse. And then with the latest SCAT 6, they made the 10-word list the standard and now added a 30-second time limit for months of the year in reverse. I swear there was a previous version of the SCAT that had a time limit, but I couldn't find it actually on any of the references that I had when I looked at the individual SCATs where it talked about a time limit. But I could have sworn that there was one that actually used a previous time limit as well. So it's interesting that they went back to this time limit of 30 seconds to complete the months of the year in reverse. I'm not sure, because again, they didn't tease that out or kind of go into further elaboration as far as why they added that back in that I remember when I looked at the write-up of the SCAT 6. So again, there's now a time limit now for the months of the year in reverse. If you don't make it in that time limit, then you don't get the credit for it. But since this is a pediatric podcast, I also need to kind of address things related to the child SCAT. So the child SCAT 3, there is a modified version of the SAC called the SAC-C. I'm really not sure there was ever any research done at that time about it as far as creating this. It was intended for 5 to 12-year-olds, although the latest version of the child SCAT 6 is only meant for 8 to 12. And that's because we got more and more evidence to suggest that we really probably can't apply a lot of these assessments to that younger age group below the age of 8. So we really don't have an actual assessment out there for those under the age of 8. So what did they do here? The modifications of the SAC for the child SCAT 3 eliminated the orientation question of time within an hour. So there was only 4 questions on the orientation. And it changed the months of the year in reverse to days of the week in reverse. And I don't know that I've ever seen a research study, and I have to go back and I'll probably have to look at this now that I'm thinking about this, that actually has looked at the utility of days of the week in reverse. I don't know that I recall a kid that I've given that test to in this younger age group that has not been able to complete it successfully. So it's interesting that that's on there. But I'm not sure that we've teased out that particular one as far as how good that one is as opposed to months of the year in reverse in this younger age group. And then the child SCAT 5 got rid of the orientation questions as well as the modified Maddox questions. And we'll talk about the modified Maddox questions. They had because I didn't talk about this at the previous one. So in the child SCAT 3, there were 4 Maddox questions. Again, not any research behind these. These were modified. So the 4 questions were, where are we now? Is it before or after lunch? It was, what did you have your last lesson or class? And that doesn't make any sense to me at all, that wording. What did you have last lesson or class? I guess it's just asking what your last subject was. Obviously, that question goes completely out the window if this is not something you're doing during a school year. And then what's your teacher's name? Now, that one by itself, I don't know why that one was added on there. How am I supposed to know what a kid's teacher's name is and if they're answering that particular one, that question correctly? And what if they have multiple teachers? You know, how do we know that which one is the right one? So anyhow, the child Maddox questions have been gone since the child SCAT 5. So we don't have those, but that's the big difference, is that the orientation questions went away from the SAC-C, a children's version of the SAC. And then there were no changes that happened to the SAC for the SCAT 6, the child SCAT 6. So if I were to just summarize things about the SAC, and again, there's lots of research studies out there looking at this much more so than compared to the Maddox questions. If you see a significant decrease in SAC scores from the baseline, that may be helpful in determining if someone is concussed. females tend to perform better at baseline than males in most of the studies that I looked at. The sac is fairly stable on repeat administrations over short and longer term, but typically does not stay abnormal for longer than 48 hours in most studies. So that's really kind of the conclusion I can come to with that. Again, we've made some modifications to these with the increase in the number of the word list, some additional things now with the time version of this. I know in the MLS, we're doing something different now, even with how we do the digits in reverse. So I'm kind of curious as far as what that will look like, especially if there may or may not be any published research that comes out from the MLS. So it'll be interesting. But, you know, again, it's probably a helpful test early in the start of an assessment of concussion, especially if you do have a baseline assessment for that. But the question is, well, how useful is it otherwise? So, you know, if you're seeing someone that's a high school athlete or collegiate athlete, and they're in the low 20s for their total score or below, odds are if your suspicion of concussion is kind of mild to moderate, that probably will sway you into it's probably more likely to be a concussion in that situation with that performance, just because we know that that's well below the mean for the numerous amounts of baseline studies we have that are out there published. So thanks for listening, and we hope you leave your 5-star review of the podcast at Apple Podcast. It helps us get the word out. Please let your friends know about us as well. Follow us on social media platforms at PEDS Sports Pod. So we're on Twitter or X, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on Threads, and check out our entire podcast library at pediatricsportsmedicinepodcast.com. I'm Dr. Mark Halstead, your host, and this has been the Pediatric Sports Medicine Podcast.
Thank you for joining us today. We hope you will join us for future episodes. Find my entire library of episodes at pediatricsportsmedicinepodcast.com. I'm Dr. Mark Halstead, and this has been the Pediatric Sports Medicine Podcast.